Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
Lots of things are better together. Hockey, food, golf, or a nice cold one on a warm spring day hanging out on the deck. But if you really want to take things to the next level, drink some Labatt Blue Lights with your friends and live life to the power of we. Always enjoy responsibly. Beer, Labatt USA, Buffalo, New York.
Upgrade your business tools with an American Express Business Platinum Card. Unlock over $1,000 per year in statement credits on select purchases in categories including tech, wireless, and recruiting. And so big expenses can deliver big benefits, you'll also earn 1.5 times membership rewards points on single eligible purchases of $5,000 or more. Terms and points cap apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/business-platinum. Amex Business Platinum. Built for business by American Express.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This is the GM Shuffle.
I actually think the bigger story of Buffalo is nothing to do with Stephon Diggs. It has everything to do with Sean McDermott, and he's going to run the defense. Can he head coach and call plays on the defense and manage the game? We shall see.
You're listening to the GM Shuffle with Michael Lombardi, presented by DraftKings and VSiN. Here is Femi Abebefe.
Welcome to another edition of the GM Shuffle with Michael Lombardi, presented by DraftKings and VSiN. I'm your host, Femi Abebefe. As always, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer, Elliot Bowman, with us on the ones and twos. Michael, how we doing, man? It's an interesting week here in June now that we're in this. The NBA and NHL are done, and we kind of turn our attention now to the NFL full-time now.
Well, we do the NFL full-time, and, you know, NFL ends pretty much this week. Every coaching staff around the league after today, the Chiefs actually get their Super Bowl championship rings tonight, and then everybody scurries away for a month-long vacation. So it's going to be you and I creating content, and, of course, we got our literature and leadership series, which brings me to the point. You know, we were scheduled to talk to Lizzie Gottlieb on Monday. And unfortunately, she just couldn't do it because her father, Robert Gottlieb, was in the hospital and he passed away yesterday. He was the ultimate editor of all books. I think he edited over 600 to 700 books. And he is probably the greatest editor in our lifetime. And unfortunately, he and Robert Caro had worked together for over 50 years collaborating on the Caro books. And he quite couldn't make it to finish the fifth and final volume on LBJ. So our condolences to Lizzie Gottlieb. And hopefully we can get her back to discuss Turn Every Page, the documentary she did on these two great men.
Yeah, no, I think that's really well said, and which even makes Turn Every Page more powerful. I know when doing the preparation for the interview, because like you said, we had it planned for Monday, and I was spending my weekend kind of learning about Lizzie Gottlieb and her father, Robert Gottlieb. And I know she said that initially that he didn't really want to do it, and she was able to kind of convince him and then his buddy, Robert Caro, to go ahead and do the project and stuff. So definitely we'll be viewing that, and also hopefully we do get Lizzie Gottlieb. But our condolences from the GM Shuffle family to Lizzie Gottlieb and the rest of the Gottlieb family after they lose their father, Robert Gottlieb, earlier this week here. But you mentioned, Michael, how we're doing the literature and leadership series here later on today. Mark DeGrandpree of the New York Red Bulls, the president and general manager, will be joining us later on in the podcast. We're excited to talk with him all things leadership styles. I know he's a big fan of Bill Belichick, the New England Patriots head coach. So I'm curious to pick his brain about how he's kind of taken some of those Belichick tropes, the Patriot way, and has sort of kind of implemented that into the organization for the New York Red Bulls.
You know, I think what we'll find in talking to Mark is that business and sports, there's a great intersection. And so the principles, you know, you think it's football and it doesn't apply to soccer. You think it's football and it doesn't apply to business. It all applies. And I think we'll be able to really scale that to where we understand it, like we did with Matt Selman. I mean, think about it. The Simpsons and football, how does that interconnect in terms of leadership? And yet it really does. So I'm looking forward to that conversation.
So that'll become up a little bit later on in the podcast. But let's get to what's been happening on the gridiron here. And it's been a busy, busy week in Buffalo. A weird week, one might say, for the Buffalo Bills. The mini camp was this week. And the big news was that wide receiver Stephon Diggs was not in attendance for the Tuesday mini camp. Now, the reporting has been a little bit murky. I'm not entirely sure what to believe with any of this stuff. But head coach Sean McDermott addressed the media earlier this week saying he was concerned about Stephon Diggs' absence. Stephon Diggs then comes the next day and practices, and then all of a sudden it's, hey, we weren't really concerned. We knew of his whereabouts. We actually gave him the excuse to go ahead and miss the minicamp, so it wasn't like it was an unexcused absence. Can you just fill us in on what is going on in Buffalo and what this might be going forward as we approach training camp next month?
Well, I mean, I think, look, you know, it's a situation up there. It's not, they say it's not related to contract, so it must be related to use of offense, style of offense, and how he is going to kind of blend within as they change. I think they're going to in a 12 personnel grouping because they drafted Dalton Kincaid. Obviously, they'll still be in three receivers. But I think, you know, what happens to a lot of teams is there is frustration when your best player, you know, can't feel like he's making the biggest contribution to the team. So, you know, one thing about the month of June, a lot of these stories get blown out of proportion. I actually think the bigger story in Buffalo is nothing to do with Stephon Diggs. It has everything to do with Sean McDermott, and he's going to run the defense. I think it has everything to do with that. I think ultimately when you see this, you know, Leslie Frazier left for health reasons or whatever, whatever you want to believe, he left for that. So, you know, Sean, instead of hiring someone to replace him, is now taking over to run the defense. And I think Leslie Frazier understood that he was in charge of running the defense, calling the defense. Remember, when it was 13 seconds left to go in that game in Kansas City, Sean took over the play caller, because he wanted to win the game. And those play calls, I'm sure a lot of Buffalo Bill fans would like to have back. So, you know, I think this is going to be the more interesting story. Can he head coach and call plays on the defense and manage the game? We shall see.
You mentioned Diggs and the usage maybe being what's the crux of the issue. I mean, he got the ball quite a bit last season. 154 targets, 108 catches, second most receiving yards in his career, the most receiving touchdowns in his career. Is it maybe the Bills are kind of shifting what they do offensively? You mentioned they're going to go to a 12 personnel team now that they have Dalton Kincaid. But Kincaid, I mean, is he really a traditional tight end, or is he more of one of those detached guys that's more of a slot kind of tight end that is essentially a kind of a pseudo wide receiver?
I think to me, you know, they need more power in what they do, right? I think for the Bills to be able to take that next step, and they were 13 seconds away from doing it 2 years ago, but to take that next step, they have to have more physicality in both lines. I think that's been the mandate, and I think that's what has to happen. And they can't rely on Josh Allen's skill as a runner to do that. They've got to have that ability to handle power. I mean, they got pushed around by Cincinnati's backup offensive line in the divisional round. So they need, to me, I think that. I think what people often confuse is the willingness to run the ball as it affects analytics, right? And that has nothing to do with it. Running the ball is about controlling it. I was listening to Larry Brown. He was on a podcast, which in the next block, we must talk about Doc Rivers' interview with Bill Simmons on the Simmons podcast. I thought it was very revealing, but we'll get to that in the next block. The thing that Brown was talking about as it relates to analytics, Larry Brown had this great saying. He said, look, I learned analytics when I was 14 years old, that, you know, I knew the difference between a good shot and a bad shot. I knew the difference between a player in foul trouble and a player that wasn't in foul trouble. I knew the difference between the team that leads in rebounding typically helps that self win. I knew the team that plays the best defense usually wins. So, you know, when you boil down all the analytics, they say, well, you can't run the ball, you got to throw it. I agree, you got to throw to score, you got to make chunk plays, but you got to control the game too. And football, going back to the 1920s, is still a game of physicality. It's still a game of who's the most physical will win. It is not a game of float like a butterfly. You know, it's not a game where you have to kind of just play within your skill set. You know, the 49ers, for all that West Coast nonsense, were a physical team when they needed to be. And I think that's what Buffalo needs to get to.
It's interesting that you bring up the 49ers, Derek, because recently on a podcast for At the Ringer, George Kittle was talking about how what's the secret behind the sauce of the 49ers making explosive plays in the passing game. And he said, quote, about Kyle Shanahan, if he wants to set up a play action pass or bootleg, he will call a run play that he knows isn't going to work. And I think for a lot of fans, it's like, what do you mean? Why would you ever call a play that's not going to work? Like, every play should be, the point is to get as many yards as possible and to get points. But sometimes, like, we always have this discussion that football is chess on grass. You got to kind of have to set some things up as well to go ahead, then get the big chunk play.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I wrote a column for VSiN's Pro Betting Guide, and I talked about play callers. You know, we only talk about play callers when the play's successful, right? Mm-hmm. We never talk about a great play call that gets you out of a bad play. We never talk about a great play call that limits the negativity within the offense or the adjustment. You know, and I think what Kittle often was saying too is the fact that Kyle does a great job of attacking the weaknesses within the scheme and tacking the specific adjustments within the scheme. See, Walsh used to say this all the time. Anybody can design run pass plays, but it takes an innovative coach to design the running game. And we often overlook that, because the running game is still, for all the analytical talk, going back to Larry Brown at 14, living in Long Beach, New York, playing on the Billy Crystal team there, it's still a game of we've got to be physical, we've got to play defense, we've got to do all those things. And I think, to me, analytics is important, but, you know, you got to have that physicality, and Buffalo doesn't.
Yeah, Buffalo did not have that physicality last season. We saw that in the snow against the Cincinnati Bengals, the game where they got beat up pretty bad in the AFC divisional round. One player that Buffalo has been linked to, though, is free agent wide receiver DeAndre Hopkins. Hopkins is going on the visit tour. He visited the Tennessee Titans. I believe, is he in New England today, or was that visit yesterday? What's the latest?
He came in last night.
Okay,
yeah.
He went in last night.
I think
night.
He came in last night to New England, yeah. Okay. I mean, look, I think he's going to take this tour. Right. We've said this all along on the podcast. He wants Odell Beckham's contract. Mm-hmm. You know, that's $15 million. And look, he doesn't practice. It's not necessarily a guy that, you know, he's a good player when he gets to the field, but all the things that it takes to become a good player, that always isn't in his what he wants to do. That doesn't mean, you know, that you got to tolerate that. I don't know how that works out. For New England, I don't see it as a fit, right? I mean, I know they're bringing him in, and people link, again, this is causation and correlation, right? People, because Belichick says great things about Hopkins, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to sign him. Right? I mean, you know, the one thing is they signed Smith-Schuster. They've got Gesicki. I think Hopkins is an inside slot receiver now at this point in his career. When he lines up on the outside, that speed is never there. It's always a jump ball. So I think this is going to go on. Tennessee brought him in. It's interesting. Somebody in the league told me Tennessee brought him in, and they wined and dined him. The problem was they flew him on a Southwest flight to Nashville. I don't think that went over so well. So, you know, I mean, if you're going to wine and dine somebody, don't put them on a Southwest flight. No disrespect to Southwest, because Southwest is always good.
Yeah, they can sponsor if they want to.
Yeah, if they want to. But if you're going to wine and dine them, I think that. I think Hopkins is going to take time. To get this Beckham contract, it's going to be a little bit. He'll do a one-year deal, I think.
Yeah.
However, that one-year deal has got to be of a high number. Would New England pay that? Look, New England has huge cap room next year. They could certainly do it. Teams, but you're borrowing on next year's cap to do it for this year. Will he move the needle to make them a, you know, would he improve their team? Yeah. I actually think Dalvin Cook would improve the Patriots team more than Hopkins.
Well, let me give you one last question on Hopkins. You said it's not a fit. Then why bring him in?
Well, I think they need to talk to him. I think they need to, you know, you bring players in to kind of collect thoughts. You don't know where this is going to go. You know, the one thing you do know is if his price comes down, you've spent time. And then I think it confirms. I think sometimes in talking about play, you want to confirm things as much as you want to find out things.
Gotcha. You're doing the homework. It's all part of the process, doing the homework there versus just making an assumption and thinking that, hey, this is a guy that's not going to fit with us. I mean, maybe you'd learn something that he actually does fit. So we will be tracking DeAndre Hopkins, maybe find a destination for Hopkins. But you mentioned Dalvin Cook. I want to ask you the latest on the Pro Bowl running back who is on the open market here. But we're going to take a quick break first. This is the GM Shuffle with Michael Lombardi. The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds, and so much more. As the first round continues on, you can bet sides, totals, player props, everything at your disposal over on DraftKings. All you have to do, download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SHUFFLE. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SHUFFLE only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
You're listening to the GM Shuffle with Michael Lombardi, presented by DraftKings and VSiN. Here is Femi Abebefe.
Before we get to Dalvin Cook, I want to ask you one last thing about DeAndre Hopkins. Where is he going next on his tour? Is there anything else that's reported out there, or is it?
I haven't heard that. Okay. I don't know where he's going next. It doesn't sound like. I think a lot of like I've said before, you only take tours when you're trying to drive up interest, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's part of what he's doing is he's letting people know he's out there. But I don't know where he could possibly go next. I mean, it doesn't sound like Cleveland's in play. I mean, when you basically tell that he wants $15 million. Essentially, that's what Beckham got, 15, plus he gets a chance to go to 17. You know, it's going to scare some. There's not a lot of money out there in the open market right now. I mean, it's hard. Now, Dalvin Cook, you know, he thinks his agent thinks he's going to get 9 per year, maybe 20 over 2, maybe 19 over 2. We'll see. But I think there is more of a market for Dalvin Cook because Dalvin Cook is younger. Mm-hmm. You know, he played 17 games last year. He can impact the run game and the pass game. And remember, the market for – I mean, Eckler just signed, and he can get up to 8.2. Mm-hmm. All the backs that signed in free agency, the Miles Sanders, you know, the Montgomery, that they're in the 6 range, you know. And so, you know, I don't think – that he's going, I think 9 is pretty fair deal for him. He's better than Sanders. He's better than Montgomery.
So are we just at this stalemate here with the running back market? Is it going to be when one player signs, whether it's Dalvin Cook or Kareem Hunt or whoever, maybe it's Saquon Barkley from the Giants come to an agreement, is that going to then open the floodgates for the rest of these guys to kind of trickle in and start to make some deals?
No, because I think if somebody overpays for a back, I don't think it's going to change the mindset of another team.
Okay.
I really don't. I think this is one of those where teams are locked into what they want to pay. I mean, Minnesota goes and releases Cook because they got Madison. I mean, it's all about their cap. You know, it's their cap situation. They're trying to clean it up, and their GM is an analytical guy. He wants to do things, you know, I'm sure he feels like running backs are interchangeable. The difference between a great one and a good one is how much, right? Mm-hmm. You know? And can you pay that? Like I've said many times, if you have a weapon in the backfield, I mean, Cook averaged over 10 yards a catch one season. I mean, that's what Keenan Allen gets, and Keenan Allen makes really good coin. So it depends on how you use the back. I mean, Barkley averaged, I think, at 6 per catch last year. If you're going to get paid huge money, you know, you got to be a factor in the passing game. I get and Barkley makes a great point. He's like, look, I'm the focal point of the offense.
Yeah.
I help you maneuver Daniel Jones around, and you pay Daniel Jones. I mean, he said it in a nice way, mm-hmm. but he said essentially what we talked about, Femi, on this podcast when all the Giant fans went hysterical. I mean, remember, they all went hysterical because I said once you pay Daniel Jones, everybody else is going to look at that contract. Of course, they went hysterical. They said I accused the Giants of having the disease of me. No, I said they potentially could have the disease of me.
Well, give it a month or so. If there's still this impasse with Barkley and the Giants, they might start to turn on Saquon Barkley. That's how these things go typically with fan bases. It's like, this guy wants too much money now and all this stuff. But we'll keep our eyes on what's going on in the Meadowlands there. But last thing on Dalvin Cook, you mentioned the agent wants $9 million, maybe 20 over two, something like that. Is that sort of money out there for Dalvin Cook, or is he going to have to eventually get down to 7.5 or 8 or something? And which teams would be willing to play ball at that number?
Yeah, I don't know if it's out there. I mean, that's his agent is pretty convinced he can get that deal. And Cook's in no rush to sign. And so I think, to me, if his agent feels comfortable it's out there, it must be out there. I don't know where it is. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said in the earlier block, I mean, New England has Stevenson as their running back. He's really a good player. They got Pierre Strong, and they've got Kevin Harris behind him. You know, the Robinson kid was a good player as a rookie down in Jacksonville. But once he got hurt, he lost that burst and acceleration, and New England didn't even want to bring him to training camp because of that. So I think, to me, where this is headed is, you know, there's got to be a team in play. We'll see. Like I said, I think Washington should be in play. No one seems to listen to that because they need a dynamic player. They need a skill player, especially running the West Coast offense with Eric Bieniemy. I mean, they need that guy. And you could say, well, you know, they have that in Gibson and they have that in Rock. I think those guys are good. I don't think they're at this level of Cook.
Yeah, well, Cook is definitely a dynamic playmaker, and that's an offense that they have the wide receivers, that's for sure, with McLaurin and the guy who they drafted, John Dotson. His name was escaping me there. But yeah, Dotson and McLaurin are really two dynamic wide receivers that could help out Sam Howell, the rookie there, or now the second-year player, I should say now, Sam Howell, who's going to be the starting quarterback for the Washington Commanders. The Minnesota Vikings released Dalvin Cook. They also, with Kirk Cousins, have the situation brewing here that could come to a head a year from now, because it sounds like there's not going to be any sort of contract restructure or extension for Kirk Cousins and the Vikings, meaning right. This season will be his free agent year. He's entering into free agency next season. Is this a situation to where we all kind of expected, hey, you said it earlier to this offseason, I got to give you credit, that you could go ahead and trade for Cousins if you want him. He's available if you want to go ahead and pick up the call. Nobody picked up the phone to go ahead and make that call there, but it looks like we're headed toward the last year for Kirk Cousins in the Twin Cities.
Well, I mean, look, you know, he voids, right? Mm-hmm. And he'll still carry debt with him when he voids. So he's going to affect next year's cap. But all these moves they're making today is to try to get their cap in some order for next season. You know, they're trying to do that. I mean, it's the same thing the Giants did this year. The Giants have spent they're going through some things to get their cap in order, and they'll be in order next year. Teams have to do this. And Cousins has been really the thorn in their side of being able to manipulate their cap. I mean, he's cost so much money, and, you know, and he's not taking a discount. And next year he should take a discount, and he'll say, I want to play, I want to play, I want to come back. We'll see what that number is.
Yeah, everybody wants to come back about what price is kind of the deal there. But for the Vikings, they drafted Jaren Hall out of BYU, the rookie. They have Nick Mullins also in that quarterback room. If they were to move on from Kirk Cousins, I mean, is it going with the developmental guy in Jaren Hall, who was a late-round pick, or do they maybe go into the market next season and try to move up for one of these other quarterbacks, like Caleb Williams? I know is a guy that you're high on, other people in the league high on him as well. Like where do they go if they were to ultimately move from Cousins a year from now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that remains to be seen. I think that's going to be they're going to have to go through the process, through the rookies, and you're going to have to get it in the draft. It depends on where they end up this season in the draft. Mm-hmm. It depends on how well Cousins plays this year. But, I mean, they're definitely looking. I mean, Kellen Mond wasn't the answer when they picked him in the third round. That was pretty clear.
Yeah, I think that was really clear. I think a lot of fans right now are probably thinking that, hey, is Minnesota maybe a potential – quote-unquote tank candidate. Now, who knows if they go that route. Kwesi Adofo-Mensah, their general manager, who you mentioned, he is very analytically driven, coming from the Cleveland Browns and that organization and all that. So I think that's a team to kind of keep an eye on. I know they won 13 games last year, but based on the moves that they've made, I mean, Danielle Hunter is out there available if a team wants to go ahead and call on that. Like, I think this is a team that is, I think, reshuffling and resetting the deck is the appropriate term, but maybe it even goes further than that and it ends up being a team that's looking toward the future and trying to acquire draft picks and just kind of selling people off.
I could see that. I think they're in a redecoration or a remodel phase.
No, 100% there. I know you wanted to hit on something that you listened to on your buddy Bill Simmons over at The Ringer, mm-hmm. his podcast. He always has a lot of great guests on, and he recently had former 76ers head coach Doc Rivers. Now, I haven't been able to listen to this podcast just yet. It's on my list of things to do here. But what was the gist of what Doc was saying in the pod with Bill Simmons?
Well, I think what he said was pretty clear. I think what he said was, well, what Doc said. I mean, Bill asked some really good questions, and Bill asked him about the process and the culture. And Doc basically said he was hired by Elton Brand, which it was true before Daryl Morey came in, to change the culture because they've spent so much time losing, they didn't understand how to win. Mm-hmm. And because they gave players so much time off, Doc, according to Doc, he had a challenge to players to play, and he felt like he finally got Embiid to play. But I thought the most revealing thing outside of the process, losing doesn't work in terms of culture, which I've been saying for 6 years, and I think Doc vindicated all those words, is the other area where I felt like was the most critical thing he said was, again, he said, look, what – Simmons said to him, what player needs to play next to Embiid? This is really important. And Doc was political when he said, well, you need another type A player, but you need somebody who's going to be able to challenge Embiid. So really what he was saying was Embiid's not a great leader. Embiid doesn't really connect to his teammates. He doesn't have that same thing that Jokic has. And he needs somebody to inspire him and drive him. And it can't be PJ Tucker because he's not a good enough player to do it. So it needs to be like when they had Butler, that's when he played the best. It wasn't because Butler played point or Butler was – it was because Butler was a good player who was could drive Embiid and basically make Embiid become a better player. That's what they need. And that's ultimately what I've been saying because if he's your leader, he's never going to work hard enough. He's never going to be the guy like we see with Jokic is. I mean, Jokic understands what it is to be a true alpha male. Embiid's not that way. He's a secondary player. And I think that's, to me, what I've been saying all along. Is he talented? Oh, there's no doubt. Even Larry Brown said the same thing. Larry Brown said, look, I'm old school. I want him in the post. I want him in good enough shape that he can run 94 feet. He should get everybody in foul trouble. But because he goes from three-point line to three-point line, that doesn't always happen. And Brown loves the kid. But I think you have to take away the veil a little bit here, and we're seeing two coaches of Hall of Fame coaches, whether Doc's in the Hall of Fame or not, certainly his regular season win total will get him there, both say essentially the same thing. And that's the challenge for Philadelphia. It isn't about do we sign a point, do we sign it off. It's about can we find an alpha dog to make Embiid better.
It almost, to me, it sounds like Embiid as a talent is a primary kind of guy, but the mentality is almost like a secondary guy. And I think if you're a general manager, and I'm sure you, being a former general manager, also a big Sixers fan, you call up the 503 area code. Call up Portland, Oregon. There's a star player out there in Portland that might be on the move that doesn't want to be a part of a rebuild. Damian Lillard, alpha dog type of mentality, a leader, has been the face of a franchise. Maybe you pair Damian Lillard with Joel Embiid.
Yeah. I mean, that might work, you know, but I think that's it. I don't know if they have any assets to get Lillard. That's the problem. Yeah. I think the reason Bradley Beal's more in play is because Washington wants to take on expiring contracts. They want to destroy it. It's going to be interesting to see Washington because they've got this committee mentality, and you know how I feel about committees, right? You know, they've never dedicated a monument to a committee, so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how they approach that in terms of their team building.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be a really, really fascinating NBA offseason. And if none of this stuff happens and Harden ends up going to Houston or Phoenix or wherever, maybe it's Joel Embiid who's looking for a new home. And it's maybe it could be the New York Knicks. It could be somewhere else. I'm just speculating here. We're just throwing stuff on the wall. We'll see what happens. But the NBA offseason will be interesting. The NFL offseason is always interesting. But on the other side, we continue our literature and leadership series. Mark DeGrandpre, president and general manager of the New York Red Bulls Major League Soccer team, joins us next here on the GM Show.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Tinder. You matched, chatted, vibe checked. Now it's time to meet IRL. So, what's stopping you? Tinder is making dating safer and easier with their excellent safety features, like Share My Date, the best way to let your friends know your plans, while Moonlight allows you to discreetly call emergency services, and Are You Sure will prompt people to think twice before sending a potentially harmful message. Explore all of the possibilities for yourself. It starts with a swipe. Download Tinder today.
Joining us now as we continue our literature and leadership series here on the GM Shuffle. This is going to be a real fun treat for us here. The former executive of the year in Major League Soccer. He has been the general manager and president of the New York Red Bulls since 2014. It is Mark DeGrandpre. Mark, we appreciate you joining us here on the podcast. Big fan of the show is what it sounds like as well. So we appreciate you being a supporter of the GM Shuffle. But how are we doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Femi. This is going to be a fun time.
Mark, we want you to know we didn't have you on the show because you like the show, so we appreciate that. That's an added bonus for us. But I like to start off with a little bit of your background in terms of how you developed yourself as a leader. I know your grandfather was the head of the Canadian business, the chairman of the board of Bell Canada, and known throughout Canada as the simplifier, the architect, and the strategist, which are all great qualities to have as a leader. So talk about your grandfather, Jean. I think it's Jean de Grandpre.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great.
I mess up names all the time, Mark, so I'm very cautious about it. And French and me are probably never going to go together very well. But anyway, so I don't want to make a mistake there.
Don't worry about it. It's been pronounced many different ways, and it's all good at the end of the day. Yes, that's a great question, Michael. My grandfather, you know, played a really, or I mean, to this day, he just passed away a year ago at 100 years old. He played an important role in my development as an individual and a leader. And I'll share this story with you guys. When we were celebrating his 100th birthday, I asked him to give me words I could share back with my son, who wasn't there on that day. He was heading off to college as a freshman. I said, what do you want to share with Tyler that he needs to take with him for the rest of his life? And he said, same thing I've told you years ago. You got to lead with love. And you've got to, you know, make sure that whenever you're taking on a new endeavor, a new team, or leading a team, you really find care in people. You find who they are. You find out who they are, what they're about, where they come from, and you get to know them. And I saw that come to life as a young child. A few times I went to the office, he knew everyone's name in the office, and he's leading a billion-dollar business in Canada. He treated everyone as if they were family, and he had very high standards in terms of the way he operated. I would have described them as a tough and caring, and I think that's some things that I've taken with him. But at the end of the day, it's the core of how I lead, and I think it's helped me get to where I am, right? With a little bit of luck along the way and the right timing. It comes down to the right people, the right culture, having the right mission and vision. And as a leader, always being able to think ahead to prepare the team for what may be coming, right? And make sure they have the resources and the freedom to do what they need to do with the business that they run eventually. But it's about the people. And that's how you succeed.
That's really interesting, because that kind of answers one of the questions that I have, was how do you kind of get people to buy in? Like, what do you do from a day-to-day standpoint there? And you talk about leading with love. It's almost in a sense where you're trying to get people to buy into your message, but you also have to buy into those people. Otherwise, your message is going to ring hollow.
Correct. No, that's another great point, Femi. I think it's really important. And when I came back to the team in 2014 here, there was, I'd say, a lack of direction and clarity on where we were going. So I engaged a lot of folks in the organization to define where we were going, right? What would be our mission as a club? What would be our vision? And what kind of plan would we lay out to get to where we want to go? And that's part of engaging the organization. And you have to be vulnerable, right? Everyone needs to know that you don't have all the answers, and never proclaimed I did, and I still don't. But I've surrounded myself with really, really smart people, a group of diverse folks who have different opinions, different points of views, different experiences, and that helps us make the right decision and become better. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think it's really important as the leader that you really focus on getting to know everyone in the organization, right? And I made a point of meeting with everyone when I came back here in 2014. I know everyone by name. I know when their birthdays are. At the end of every year, I send them a handwritten note thanking them for their contribution to the club, right? And those are the little things I think that make a difference that I drew from my grandfather, my father, and other leaders I've been around throughout the years.
You know, when I go out to Mark, when I go out to the South Point out in Las Vegas, where we have a studio, the owner of the South Point is a tremendous man. His name is Michael Gaughan, and he sounds very much like your grandfather. Michael Gaughan on Thursday at the restaurant there will have 8 or 9 employees have lunch with him. And he constantly is asking them about what they can do, about their jobs. He knows their names. He knows their backgrounds. And that engagement really grounds him within his own building. And it's the reason why the South Point is so successful. And I just finished a book called Belonging by Owen Eastwood. And it kind of lines with this, too, because Eastwood talks about how do you create a sense of belonging? Most people want to be part of something bigger than themselves, right? And so how do you create the us versus I? And what your grandfather did was remarkable. Have you had any struggles with, you know, because you're dealing with so many different cultures of unifying everybody into that us environment?
Mm-hmm. It's a big challenge in soccer across the different cultures we bring in and the front office, the sporting staff, to making sure everyone's aligned behind that mission and being part of something bigger than themselves. Even internally here, when we talk about who we are, we're not just a soccer team that's trying to win games, right? That's too cliche. It's prototypical in sports. Yes, we want to win games. We want to win a championship. But ultimately, our purpose is to help develop, inspire, and engage the local community, right, through the game of soccer. And if we do that well on the pitch, off the pitch, that's when we start winning. And ultimately, yes, winning the MLS Cup is going to drive a ton of engagement and inspire the local community. But all our efforts are geared towards that, and that means engaging the players to understand what they have to do in the community to drive engagement, and obviously performing on the pitch, how important that is. But from Maria, who cleans the building with Israel every day for the staff and our guests when they come on game days, they understand their role in the organization, how they drive that experience, and they can drive that engagement. And they're committed to make sure this place is the safest and cleanest building we have. And it's really driving that message down and making sure everyone understands it clearly. And as a leader, my job is to reinforce that message consistently, wherever and whenever I can with the staff. And to your point, it's meeting with a smaller group across the organization. We call them sensing sessions here, where everyone comes in and it's a small group, 8 to 10 folks, and they can ask me about anything. And I ask them to give me feedback on how I'm doing, how the leadership team is doing, and what can we do better to drive deeper engagement across the organization.
You know, Michael mentioned it earlier just in this interview here, how you grew up in Canada. And I'm assuming for a lot of people who grew up in Canada, they play hockey as you did. So I think in doing our research, it was really cool to kind of figure out your path to the MLS. But I want you to share with our audience who might not be familiar with your story, how did you go from growing up playing hockey to an executive role now in Major League Soccer?
Trust me, a running joke back home in Canada. How did a young man who loved hockey, played hockey all his life, played college, played baseball and hockey, and never really played soccer? I played some indoor soccer when I was tiny, on a rink in the summer when there was no ice. That was about it. So I was fortunate to be one of the first employees at Red Bull in North America on the canned sales side, on the beverage side, in the late 90s. And for about 10 years or so, or a little less, 7 years, I was managing that business and built it out in the East Coast. And in 2006, when our owner bought the Metro Stars, I mentioned luck earlier. I was fortunate enough to be in the office when he came in, and no one else was in there. And he just said to me, "All right, let's go. We're going to go to New York City." And I'm like, "Okay, why are we going to New York City?" And he just said, "Well, we're going to go buy the Metro Stars." And that sank in. I'm like, okay, I got a day job here. I got to sell your cans and make sure we keep driving the business. And once the transaction was done, he said, listen, go inform the guys at the Metro Stars that we bought them. And for the next 30 days, I want you to make sure that when I come back for our first game, the Red Bulls are playing. So that's how my sort of journey in soccer started. And I made no bones about it with the owner. I'd never been played soccer, none of that. Gave me a rule book to figure this out. I'll be back in 30 days, and I expect the Red Bulls to be playing. And something I didn't think was possible, we made it happen.
So right. That's how I think that's to me is the reason why we wanted to have you on today, is because, you know, sports and business, there's an intersection. It's really comes down to the same thing. It comes down to culture, a sense of belonging first, right? And you have to have that, and then you have a culture, and then you have people that adapt to the culture. So you just recently made a coaching change, right? What went through your mindset on why you wanted to make a change? And then what did you look for in terms of finding somebody that could then deliver the change you needed?
It's a great question. When you think about the decisions you make when you're making a coaching change or a staffing change internally in the front office, whatever it may be, you just hit it, Michael. It comes down to, I'd rather invest in someone who's going to champion and believe in our culture and fits our culture than someone who is highly skilled and may maybe have more experience or more talented in certain areas, because the intangible of the character and the culture belief and the buy-in and the engagement to me drives ultimate long-term success. And those are the variables we thought about during this last transition. And we knew that the assistant coach that we had in-house could potentially fill that role. And he's proven us right since we've made that decision. So to me, it comes down to that person sharing the similar values we have as an organization, as an individuals in the organization, believing in where we want to go in that culture, and being able to champion that culture and really drive deep engagement with the team and the players and making them believe also.
Well, I want to follow up on that, Mark, there, because I think that really intersects all aspects of life, whether it's you have a job in business or you have a job in the medical field or a job in sports. Like, why do you think it is to where oftentimes organizations overlook those traits and kind of just look at the specific, oh, what's the skill? What's the resume? What does this look like? Like, why do you think people overlook the traits that you would want to that would be able to actually fit into a culture and go more towards resume build type of stuff?
That's a great point, Femi. I think there's a reluctance. There's sort of a comfort zone to look at a resume, experience, skill set, and say, okay, this person's going to be able to do the job and deliver some results. And that's an easy decision to make when you look on paper, you go through the interview process and you assess skill and talent. The intangible to me that is much more important in that process is understanding the individual, where are they from, what they believe in. As I said a minute ago, do they share those same values we do as an organization? Can they help us elevate the culture and make it more meaningful and powerful and engaging? That's an intangible and something you can't measure, that some folks are uncomfortable going there and making that hard decision. And we have these debates in here oftentimes. We're recruiting a new head of HR right now, and there's some folks who look at the resume and say, oh, experience X, Y, and Z, much stronger than candidate B for X, Y, and Z reasons. And then you've got to push and probe about their thoughts on the personality, the values of these individuals. And I think to me, it's the difficult part of the job. And also, over the last few years, you've seen more of a shift towards thinking about those intangible characteristics of individuals. And to me, it comes down to character ultimately, and their beliefs and their values and where they grew up. You know, one of the questions I ask is, don't tell me about resume. Tell me everything that's not on the resume about who you are, everything that occurred before you went to college and you could write on your resume. I want to know who you are and where you grew up. And, you know, people who have been through tough times are more resilient. You learn through those conversations where they've been and what they value. And those are the things I think really make a big difference at the end of the day.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so your owner, you're working for Red Bull. Your owner comes in and said, we bought a soccer team. Were you a little intimidated by how you thought soccer, the execution of soccer to win, football as they call it, how the game needed to be played in order for the Red Bulls to become a great team? Understanding we have to build a culture, but how to play, you know, was that something that worried you because you hadn't had a background in soccer?
100%. I mean, I that's where when we talk about surrounding each other with people who know what they're doing and are smarter than you or have different experiences, that's where it really became important to me and valuable to the organization. Defining how we would play would have to be part of our culture and our identity. And it's very much a foundational pillar of what we look for in players and staff, because we don't want the club to be defined by one coach who comes in, brings in his own culture, leaves, right? We all know coaches are going to change. We want to make sure that the culture remains and the values and the way we play and all those things are going to be part of that fabric and DNA. So I relied on experts wholeheartedly to make those decisions and learn from them a ton throughout the years to be able to help us get to where we are today. Obviously, we haven't won the big one yet, Michael, but it's, as I keep reminding everyone, there's one team every year. And if we measure our success every year based on that, not winning that final game, I don't think it's fair to the 160 people who work in this organization, because there's a lot of good work happening and a lot of things have to align for us to win that final game.
You can give yourself some credit. You guys have made the playoffs every single year since you've been there. You know, you haven't won the big one yet, but you've made the postseason. And I kind of follows to my next question here is that I think one of the trickier things is to get people to buy in when the results aren't immediate. And I know that you guys are chasing the MLS Cup. That's obviously the holy grail of what you want to accomplish there. But can leadership and can these philosophies be, I guess, brought into an organization without having those results immediately? Because eventually people are going to say, all right, well, we're not having the success that we want, so why should we be listening?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think you have to, as I just said, you have to highlight all the wins along the way, the things that change, the things that improve, the constant progress. We talk about being 1% better every day here, and we highlight all the successes we have other than on the pitch to show that we're going in the right direction. And ultimately getting to the playoffs, to your point, Femi, 13 years in a row, it's consistent excellence over 34 matches. And now is how do we fine tune the ingredients on the pitch and with the team to make sure we have more success in this tournament at the end of the year. But anywhere else in the world, you know, over the last 14 years, we've won 3 supporter shields. It's a pretty consistently successful soccer organization. And in Europe, we would have been crowned champions 3 times, actually, over the last 10 years since 2013. So that would be considered a really good run. Unfortunately or fortunately, in the U.S., there's a tournament and there's a cup. But we're fine tuning. And everyone understands that, you know, when you look at goals, you're not always going to reach them. And you're going to fail and learn and grow from those. And that's really important to remind everyone in the organization. We're going to set goals. We're going to be aspirational. We're going to want to hit some high targets. We may not get there every year, but we're going to learn from not getting to where we're going to go, and we're going to continue to get better. Where I really get, I'd say, more intense and strict and disciplined is around standards and the way we behave as an organization, right? How we act every day. Those are sort of non-negotiables for us in this organization. Mm. You know, if you don't put the team first, you don't make decisions in the best interest of the team, if you don't ask teammates if they need help every day, those are things we will not be flexible around. That's part of our culture and our DNA. And that's when we hold people accountable and there's consequences. On the goal side, there's going to be consequences eventually, but we need to learn and grow. If we can continue to show that, then we'll be successful.
Yeah, I mean, that you see that as your job. You see that as the standard of excellence evaluator. I mean, to me, just listening to you, you understand that you have to hold people accountable, and that goes for yourself and everybody else in the organization. So as you know, one of the things I want to talk about is team building. So the players matter. and the player's character matters. So when you're setting up this organization, did you go to the personnel department and say, these are the kind of people we want, and this is what we're looking for? And then how does that how do you manage that relationship? Because in pro football, you know, when the team's not doing well, it's the players are good, the coach stinks, or the coach thinks the players stink. It's that constant battle back and forth. How do you navigate that from your seat in terms of standards?
So when you think – it's a great question, Michael. When we think about who's involved in those decisions, and our head of sport, our sporting directors, our scouts, they all understand the standards we have, what we look for in player, what we expect in players. And they have a very detailed, diligent system to make sure there's always going to be error, right? You're not going to hit, you're not going to bat 1,000 every season. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to learn. But we want to minimize that risk through this process and system and the standards we've set up. And those folks, I have full trust and belief in them that they're constantly holding themselves to the right standards and holding themselves accountable against those standards to make sure that whoever we bring in, or coach, assistant coach, or players, fit within the standards we have. And if they don't, then we make changes.
It's funny. Tell me, I would jump in for a second. When you look at the New Zealand All Blacks, they have 15 principles, what they call standards, right? And so everybody in the organization knows these principles, you know, sweep the shed, go for the gap, play with a purpose, pass the ball, create a learning environment, you know, no dickheads, no assholes, you know, embrace expectations, train to win, keep a blue head, know thyself, invent your own language, sacrifice, you know, have rituals to actualization, be a good ancestor, and write your own legacy. So they kind of, that's their job. That's who they are. And I think when you have standards, that's who you become. Especially, how did you deal with, you didn't have a history. You know, the All Blacks wear that fern on their chest and they say, you know, we've worn this to wear this fern. You have to represent who we are going back 50 years. How did you compensate for the lack of history?
It came through some of the players we brought in early on who set those standards. I'd mentioned Juan Pablo Angel, who's one of the, I think, our second designated player back in 2007. He came in and really helped us set the right standards for the organization on the sporting side, for the young players, our academy. We were one of the first teams who had an academy back in 2006.
Love that.
That player helped us set a standard it's still here. Juan Pablo has long left the club. He went to finish his career in LA. He's now working for another team. But those standards that he helped us set are still living and breathing here. And you can feel him in the building. And it's now any new employee gets it when they walk in and it's sort of, I don't want to say by osmosis, but they understand it. It's on paper, they see it, and they know where they're going. And it's interesting, Michael, you mentioned the All Blacks, because every new employee, when they come in here, gets a book from me, and that's the book they get to read.
That's great. I love that. I think, to me, that you see that is the way, Mark, the way you approach your job, and I think this is really critical for coaches, too, is you approach your job as the teacher of the culture, right? You know, everybody just assume culture's like carpet. It just gets laid and it stays there. Whereas you see it as it's your job to do that. And that's very Belichickian in the sense that if you don't work on it every day, it's going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. It's written in front of me at my desk. That's my number one job, is to manage the culture, make sure we have the right folks within the organization who live it, breathe it every day. And as I said earlier, when we started the conversation, it's about reinforcing it, communicating it as often as I can. I don't think we don't have an all staff where I talk about the culture or some teammates that exemplified the culture over the last 30 days. And that is my number one job as the leader of the organization. I think for any leader in any organization, that is their priority, to make sure that culture and those standards are upheld every day. And I'd like to say that's why we've made the playoffs 13 years in a row, and we're going to keep going, and we're eventually going to get to where we want to be, and we'll be the last one standing eventually.
I want to get to more in Major League Soccer and everything with you guys do, but I want to kind of veer off to some of the more personal side of things, because I think one thing that's really cool and could be really valuable for a lot of our listeners is that, hey, we're all learning how to lead at work, but what about away from work? What about at home, within your family? Like, how does your leadership style change? And maybe it doesn't change, but does it change when you go from, all right, I'm president and general manager to the New York Red Bulls, to when you go home, I'm the father, I'm a husband? Like, how does that kind of change? Or is there maybe some intersection there as well?
There's definitely, I think, you know, you both know you're in sports. It comes home with you ultimately. But I draw a lot from my wife, who's been the backbone of our family. We have two great kids, one who's in college, and a young girl who's 15, Julia, who's in a special needs school in New Jersey here. What I've drawn from my family, Femi, is the ability to be resilient, right? Our daughter was born with disabilities, and she's been through it's been a challenging life for her, and it's going to be. But through her, I've found hope, I've found resilience, and I've found belief. And I'll give you an example of this and how my family has influenced my resilience and grit. A normal child learns to ride a bike, you know, by the age of 5, and it takes him a few tries, get up and down. My daughter kept trying for 8 years to ride a bike and never gave up. And finally, the 8th year, during the COVID year, everything happens for a reason. I'm at home in my home office, and she's outside trying, falling, getting back up, trying, and she finally got it. And if she can keep going for 8 years to learn how to pedal a two-wheel bicycle, I mean, that's resilience, that's stick-to-itiveness, not giving up. And that is something I've learned from my family, from my son, who's been there helping us manage this, who's been patient, he's been caring, loving, and he's made our lives easier by really taking care of himself, right? And taking care of his education, his sports career in high school, and now in college, he's doing phenomenal, because he knows that we don't have to worry about him. And he made sure we didn't have to worry about him. And when you think about holding each other accountable in an organization, is, you know, I look to my left and right, my teammates better be taking care of their jobs, so I don't have to worry about it. And I'm going to remind them if they're not. But our son made sure he took care of himself and did everything the right way, so he wasn't a burden on us. And he went through some tough times when he was 12 years old. We almost lost him. Again, he fought through it, and it was that resilience in both our kids that we've had, and my wife for raising two amazing kids, has helped me become a better leader, right? Communication at home, opening that up, being vulnerable, all those things have translated to work and hopefully have made me a better leader along the way.
Boy, that's an incredible story, yeah. Mark. I mean, she sounds like a lesson in competitive stamina every single day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's powerful. When you have that reminder every single day in front of you, from someone else to you, it's a powerful lesson. I wanted to ask you, all these things we talk about today are great, and I believe in every one of them wholeheartedly. But if the owner doesn't believe in this, there's chaos. And did you get the owner of the Red Bulls to buy into this immediately, or was this part of his DNA? Because some owners will say, I want to do this, but once it gets hard, they bail. Once the media gets on them, they bail. So talk about how your owner has allowed you to do what you need to do. Great cultures that I've seen in sports really is about the owner's willingness to allow it to establish. Pat Riley in Miami, Belichick in New England. Kraft allows it to establish. You know, same thing in Miami. Talk about your owner.
I think that's a great question. The relationship I had with him, being one of the first employees to help launch Red Bull in North America, I can't say I was close to him, but I got to know him. I was in meetings with him. And when we bought the team, I got much closer to him because I had direct relationship. He built everything I wanted to instill here is similar to the beliefs he had and how he built Red Bull, the brand. So it was an easy conversation with him. And you talk about owners who bail out. He's been consistent every year. We've reinvested, we've invested, and we've kept going, and we've doubled down at times. and his commitment to seeing this team succeed ultimately has never wavered. Unfortunately, we lost him last year, but his son is now leading the organization and a board, and they're going to make sure that his legacy continues on. And the values I shared with this organization were part of the values our owner has ultimately.
Before we let you go here, Mark, we got to ask you the biggest news in the MLS. I mean, Lionel Messi, arguably the greatest player in the history of the sport, joining Inter Miami. I mean, what does that do for just the spotlight on Major League Soccer? Obviously, it's a sport that almost approaching 30 years here in a couple of years that it's been in our country. Like, what does that do for the sport and for you guys as well as competitors? I mean, this kind of continues the arms race of some of these international superstars coming over here to the States.
What a tremendous signing by Miami, right? It's amazing for the league. You saw what it did. I'm watching the NBA Finals, the pregame show, and they're talking about the Heat, the Panthers in the finals, and then Messi in Miami, right? That would have never happened in the MLS. That would have never happened, the MLS being talked about during the NBA Finals. So the interest we got in the game instantly was sold out in a matter of minutes here locally, and every away game and their home games are all sold out. I think it elevates the platform for MLS to become relevant awareness across the globe. You're going to see the Apple subscriptions skyrocket around the globe because everyone's going to want to see Messi in his last few years. And it also, to your point, Femi, it's going to put more pressure on all the owners to continue to invest in the product to make sure we keep elevating the talent that's on the pitch in MLS, right? And we have the World Cup coming here in a few years. This is just another great step in us getting better, continue to invest in our product, and become much more relevant on a global platform. And ultimately, that's what we want to be. And in North America, we want to be in the top four at some point, and we're going to get closer, and Messi's going to help us get there.
Yeah, before we let you go, I want to know, we mentioned Legacy, which is an incredible book. Two other books that you absolutely have changed your leadership style, and then what books are you currently reading right now?
Great question. Right now, I'm reading Let Them Lead. It's by John Bacon. It's literally a high school hockey coach in Michigan that talks about his story of becoming a coach of a team that was underperforming and then becoming I think they became state of their champions of their sectional, but the process he went through to get there. So that's what I'm reading right now. It's a great book. I'm listening to Luke Russert's book as well. Books that have influenced me. Boys in the Boat is one that I've really enjoyed and that I've shared with my leadership team over the years. Really good book about, I mean, the importance of being in sync as a team, right? You can't get more in sync than on a boat where you're rowing together. If one person is not in sync, you can't get there. And it really defines teamwork, communication, and being together. So I love that book. One that everyone should read that I've reread recently, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a simple book, but it's an important book because at the end of the day, it all comes down to relationships. So those two are important. And then I would say also, one that I really enjoyed was the Bill Walsh book, right? The Score Will Take Care of Itself. That's important. And I love the Ian O'Connor book on Bill Belichick as well.
Yeah, that's awesome stuff there. I think this has been a really fun conversation, Mark. We appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the GM
Mark,
Shuffle.
Thank you. I'm a Red Bull fan now. I promise you that. That's awesome.
Love it. Thanks for having me, guys. This has been really a pleasure.
I'm a Seattle guy. Obviously, I root for the Sounders, but if they're not playing the Sounders, I will be rooting for the New York Red Bulls there. You guys, in the pursuit of the elusive MLS Cup, now it's going to be a lot of fun tracking you guys the rest of the season. If there's a lesson that's to be learned, lead with love. And that's what we're going to do here on the GM Shuffle podcast. Mark DeGrandpre, we appreciate you taking the time to join us here. That does it for this edition of the GM Shuffle. Thank you to our producer, Elliot Bowman, with us on the ones and twos. Thank you to DraftKings. Thank you to Veasan. Thank you to you, Michael. Once again, thank you to Mark DeGrandpre. And we will talk to you guys on Monday.